Hey everybody, welcome back to Bald Move Prestige. Today, we're going to be talking about a little film that came out in 2013 called The Wolf of Wall Street, directed by a little-known director, Martin Scorsese. The screenplay was by Terrence Winter. It's based on The Wolf of Wall Street by Jordan Belfort, which gets turned into Belmont, because this is a... Right?
Stays his real last name, yeah.
Okay, because this is a lightly... or maybe heavily fictionalized account of his life story.
Yeah. I mean, do you believe that the guy is in his autobiography telling the truth? And B, do you believe that he has actually accurately captured that?
Who knows? Yeah. There's two layers of fuckery in which you can view the lens of this movie. It stars so many famous people. Leonardo DiCaprio is the titular wolf. Jonah Hill, who is fully insane this entire fucking movie. Uh-huh. Margot Robbie, who is incandescently hot. Matthew McConaughey, which he has a brief but iconic and cadaverous kind of role to play as an 80s, greed is good style stockbroker that takes the wolf in as a cub and teaches him the ways of fucking with people's money. Rob Reiner is in this film that I'd forgotten about. John Favreau, Favs, is in here.
Thomas Middleditch is in here at one point.
Thomas Middleditch, before I even knew who the fuck he was, I think Shea Whigham.
Yep.
Coming into the third season of Boardwalk. But I think I'd seen this movie first, so I didn't really know who Shea Whigham was. I didn't know who Terrence Winter was. This was right before we started doing kind of pop culture on Bald Move. So. Yeah. Like once we get past 2013, 2014, like almost every movie that was prominent or Oscar winning, we probably saw and covered. But this is one of those few right in that transition period that kind of got left behind.
Kristen Milioti, who's I feel like blowing up or has blown up in the last 7 years since this.
Right. Wasn't she the Time Warp movie?
Spring Break. Uh-huh. Palm Springs. No, Spring Break is totally different. Movie.
It's also twisted and psychedelic.
I love that. Yeah.
So I went into this movie. I remember really enjoying the first movie, or the first time I saw it. And I think I saw this twice when it came out, once in the theaters and once on video. And I was worried that when I watched it again that, cause I've, changed a little bit as a person in the last 7 years, like, would I like it as much? Would I find it as interesting? And I think I feel pretty much the same way, that this movie is like Goodfellas, another Martin Scorsese movie that this shares a lot of DNA with. This movie is a ton of fun up until the point it's not.
Yeah.
And then it's pretty, pretty miserable when the chickens come home to roost and the piper has to be paid and the full awfulness of this lifestyle kind of rears its head. Goodfellas was more punctuated by truly awful things. Although I guess, I don't know, no one gets stabbed to death in the early goings of this, but women are ritually humiliated. The damage that people do to their bodies is immense. You also don't see it, but it's implied the destruction of so many people's lives, especially, they're preying on working class people, plumbers, firemen, the carpenters, mailmen, people that don't have money to blow, that just want a slice of the American dream. They're destroying these people financially.
It's a true carnage in this film.
Yeah, but you don't really feel that. Because Jordan, Belfort is having this amazing time with hookers and blow and supermodels and drugs and like insane salesmanship. What did you think of the film?
I got something controversial to say, because Martin Scorsese is such a famed, such an iconic director. And, when you talk about stuff like Goodfellas, it's almost not even like interesting to compare this to Goodfellas, because it is Goodfellas. It's just Goodfellas on Wall Street.
It's white collar Goodfellas.
Yeah, absolutely. Through and through. But I'm going to say that this is maybe his most culturally relevant film. And look, I haven't seen all of Martin Scorsese's work, But this speaks to like an issue that is happening in the here and now. Whereas you look at these gangster films like Casino and Goodfellas, and that shit's old, right? Like that's old news. Like there aren't, you know, organized Italian crime gangs going around murdering people in the streets anymore. Like the organized crime is still a thing. I don't want to get it, you know, twisted here, but as far as relevancy goes, this is a much more relevant film, I think, than any of those gangster films he's done in the past. Or the Irishman or anything like that, right?
I was going to say, ironically, his most relevant gangster film right now is Gangs in New York, which says a lot about right. The state of America and where we're at right now. But yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong.
And when I think of Martin Scorsese, I don't think of like culturally relevant stuff. I don't think of like, oh, here's a hard hitting take on the American dream. But like this movie gets most of the way there, I think, even though I would say it's maybe a little too fun for its own good. But that's the point, right? This movie is incendiary. It's supposed to make me disgusted with the characters and their crimes and myself for enjoying the film. Like I don't come out of this movie feeling like, either I just watched an amazing, 3 hours of debauchery and fun. I also don't come out of this movie thinking, boy, I hate everything that I just saw. Like, I don't know. I feel like other films would take an angle and go with it. Whereas this presents this presents it in a way where like I get so wrapped up in enjoying what I'm seeing until I realize that I'm enjoying it too much and I should be hating everything that's happening on screen.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
To pivot on that point or continue on that point, I read a lot of contemporary think pieces and interviews where they say like concurrent, you know, Wall Street bad boys love this movie. Unironically love this movie in much the same way that the movie itself predicted when they showed that, you know, this Jordan Belfort character got, this piece on Forbes, which he thought was a hatchet job, where it's like, oh, this guy's just, you know, lying and stealing and manipulating and making tons of cash. It's disgusting. And the next day they had guys lined out the door to work for him because that's everything they want to be. And it's hard to judge art by the worst people who enjoy it, right? You know, because I've seen a lot of people hewing and hemming and hawing about, oh, you know, Godfather glorifies mafia culture and Goodfellas glorifies mafia culture. And it kind of does. Mm-hmm. But it also it allows you to, I mean, kind of like the way we talked about the Hitchcock film last week, you know, you get sucked into doing these bad things. And then when the camera gets spun around and you start seeing like, oh, well, do you like this? Well, how about this? How about this? Is this okay? And you start feeling increasingly kind of queasy.
Yeah.
Just like Hitchcock said about the people that kind of like catch the breath when, you know, Norman Bates like is about to get foiled to get away from the crime. Like these kind of movies play with that. And I think decent people can, you know, see why this is seductive, to see why a person, especially like Jordan Belfort, that came from nothing, you know, came from below middle class where and gets this, like, why, you know, this is so seductive, but also why this is kind of what's wrong with the American dream, that like this is this the American dream, like using people and taking advantage of chumps, yeah, and making yourself rich at the expense of making other people poor, and then doing what with it?
Yeah.
You know,
and they set that all up right with this Matthew McConaughey character in the beginning, who's basically saying, yeah, we don't make anything, and our whole existence is simply to put money in our pockets while we keep these fools on a merry-go-round where they right. eventually lose all their money. Like, yeah, that's you know, that is a predator-prey relationship that is
right.
disturbing.
But it's wild because, like, I don't think that's it's so funny to hear Matthew McConaughey state that, because I think there's a you know, the opposite of crazy is crazy, you know, like stock market's all, it's like all this economy is just bullshit, it's sprinkly, it's magic fairy dust. It's like that belies a lot of like sound economic fundamentals with fiat currency and market forces and all that kind of stuff that are very powerful, very useful, and are great at generating like just wealth in general. And it's also kind of insane to say that like none of that's effective. It's all or you know, it's like the truth is somewhere in the middle. But for these guys, the fact that, yeah, like their clients, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they make money or not, because they're making money on them trying to make money. They're right. making money on the commissions. They're making money. And, you know, this takes place, what, in the 80s and 90s before you had, you know, the internet kind of came along and had like zero fee trades and no commission kind of structures, and people could, you know, do more prudent things like invest in 401ks and Roth IRAs and not just essentially gamble on especially penny stocks. Holy shit.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's like that same mentality, that gambler's mentality that bankrupts people at casinos, the same thing that can bankrupt people on Wall Street if they're not, you know, paying attention and are not in it for a long haul investment.
Yeah, I guess the interesting thing, like some people I think miss, and it's easy to miss. I don't fault them for missing this, but this movie is not all fun and games. You know, Jordan Belfort, the end of the movie shows you, it all circles back around, because at the beginning of the movie, he says, like, if you have enough of this drug, and he's talking about money, you're invincible, right? You've got nothing to fear. Can vanquish your enemies, all that stuff. And then at the end of the movie, we show him going to prison for 22 months or whatever he did.
36 months.
Yeah, he ended up serving 22 because, of course, a sentence is not
actually really? It's not even as bad as they made it out to be in the movie? Holy fuck.
So yeah, he goes away for the 36 months. But he's in fucking Club Med, right? He's playing tennis with his buddies in Ascots. Like, this is bullshit.
Club Fed,
You are supposed to feel an anger at that, right? But also at the same time, what I think you miss in this whole equation is that, yes, he's gotten off basically scot-free in a financial and lifestyle sense, but he's lost his wife. He's lost two wives over the course of this, actually. He's lost his kids. He's lost his houses. That's the thing that I don't think the movie does enough to point out, is the carnage that this lifestyle reaps on his own life, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing, because I think that, like, if you ask Scorsese that, he'd be like, well, that's the point, you know, you're I want to make it seem like this guy who lives this crazy, crazy lifestyle, who's hurt all this people, doesn't really pay a consequence, and you should take that anger out of the theater with you, and you should take that into your politics. You should take that in your understanding of criminal justice. You should take that into the way you vote and the way you invest your own money, and it should change the world. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know. I don't think it really does. Like, there's been a lot of research and study on how, if you parody things, you do things like this, It normalizes it more than it does galvanize people, because the anger that you feel about, like, holy shit. And the movie itself skips over, like, when he rinses his hands of his first wife, you never see or hear from her again.
Yeah.
And I think he had kids in that marriage too. And, you know, he punches Margot Robbie twice, and he tries to do a Walter White and steal his daughter. He gets into his car wreck, could have killed them both. And that just too is a consequence that gets skipped over. And even when it feels like the movie starts to feel heavy, and he's like living with his, you know, guilt over turning state's evidence on his friends and ruining all of them, then there's this like where it's like the movie's starting to kind of like sit with his despair. Then he comes in with a voiceover and it's like, you know, I almost forgot one thing. I'm rich. Uh-huh. And then, you know, he recovers and it ends with him. And, like, you know, obviously he's going to get all of his houses back and all that stuff.
Well, so that, like, was the most, that's the thing that pissed me off the most. And the mm-hmm. thing that made me feel the grossest about this whole system is that scene where he's sitting around his pool and he's talking with Jonah Hill. And he's got this ankle bracelet, right? He's under house arrest.
Right.
And Jonah Hill's like, he's saying, oh, we're going to have to sell the house to, you know, pay all the lawyer fees and all this stuff. Jonah's like, I got you. I got you. These people are fucking invincible, right? Like, you get rich enough, you know enough people, and there's nothing they can do to you that will actually stick, because your buddies will come in and bail you out because you've bailed them out. And it's just this cycle that there's no check. There's no balance. There's nothing. These people will continue to get away with it until everyone's just says enough is enough.
And that's the way it's always been. Like, you know, when you do, you look at like the old debtors prisons that they used to have before they, it's like, obviously that's insane. You throw people for owing money into jail and they can't earn money. But the reason that went on for so long is it never affected the upper classes, because it's understood that if a proper gentleman lost some money or had some hard times, his other gentleman friends would help him out, you know, get a couple few thousand pounds and you settle the debt and the other guy gets paid and this guy's learned a hard lesson and you move on.
Yep.
But that just doesn't apply to the middle classes, where, you know, it's like, okay, well, yeah, I've got some friends that might have a few thousand pounds, but then they'll be bankrupt too. And the lower classes, like, fuck, yeah, no, they're just going to rot in prison for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's taken us 250 plus years to reinvent a class and peerage system here in the United States that was designed to undo all that stuff. Because, yeah, like, you know, it's like there's this story going around right now where a black woman's going to jail for 5 years for accidentally committing voter fraud, where she voted in the wrong precinct that she wasn't supposed to. And then you got a thing like this where, you know, Jordan Belfort, who steals millions and millions of people over the course of a decade and kills three people, apparently, in his greed, at least. You know, like, and that's just like a throwaway line in the movie. He gets 36 months prison and 22 months actual. And then they make, I mean, all this stuff is driven home. Like, the FBI officer who is like riding the subway and kind of like looking at this, you know, headline about his life's work up to that point, taking this guy down, and how, like, it's not even really, you know. But the thing is, like I said, like, the anger lasts for 5 minutes after you get in the movie. And then you think, when I think about The Wolf of Wall Street, before I sat down and watched it, I thought about how fun it is to watch Leo try to drive his Lamborghini on Superludes. I thought how fun it is that Jonah Hill acts like a crazy person at every point in the movie. And the popcorn cotton candy stays with you, but the anger and the sickness of the pit of your stomach goes away, you know?
Yeah. No, you're right.
So, I think we should talk about the merits of the film itself, because there are just some ferocious performances, especially by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill. This is the thing movie that put, like, kind of Jonah Hill on the map for me, because
is this post Moneyball? Is this, I don't remember.
Yeah, no, it turns out Moneyball came out 2 years before this. So that was kind of his feet wet into serious acting.
Yeah.
And then since Wolf of Wall Street, he's done far more kind of serious acting than he does, than he's done, you know, lunatic off the wall stuff. But this is, the other thing is this is a this film is a comedy, and it works as a comedy. Mm-hmm. Like a black comedy that lasts three fucking hours. That's the other thing, is I remember we had so much stuff to watch in the last couple of days. When I saw that this thing was fully 3 hours long, I despaired. But I swear to God, watching it feels like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Like, the time flies by.
It breezes by. I think like maybe you could have cut out a little bit of the partying. I don't know that you needed so many scenes of that, but ultimately like it is fun. And, you know, that's kind of serving the purpose, right? The partying is part of it. It's about the lifestyle. It's about, you know, it's about that juxtaposition between how you should feel about this and how you do feel about it.
Yeah, and I feel like that's part of the point of the movie is there's about 4 points where you think, ah, this is where the worm's going to turn. This is where the chickens are going to go home to roost. This is where it's going to get bad. But the movie just keeps trucking. No, they survive that with very little consequences, a slap on the wrist at best, and then they go bigger and better and harder. Yeah. So like nothing ever really, really stops them. And they even make that point like in the beginning of the movie where, you know, Jordan is just getting started. He hasn't got a Series 7 license to be an official stockbroker yet. And he's working at this, you know, high power prestige stockbroker firm. And he finally gets his license on that day. It's Black Friday, whichever it was in the like 1989 when the stock market
Black Monday.
Historic crash. That we've had like 3 worse ones since. And he loses his job, and like Matthew McConaughey probably overdoses on coke that night. So that feels like a setback, right? But it's not, because then he gets introduced. He goes into this Long Island penny stock trading firm, which looks like it's the seediest, grossest place in the world. And I don't know, like what's the deal with penny stocks? Because it's like it seems like what he's doing is obvious. He's just selling, like, penny stocks themselves are snake oil, and he's just like doing a snake oil salesman. Like, what were these fuckers doing before he came along that they were struggling? Because it seems like that's a way you can make a lot of money.
I think they were just doing the same thing except poorly. You know, he's like a magician on the phone to them. So yeah, they just couldn't sell.
And, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio has a quiet little career of effortlessly selling some superhuman talent, like a great salesperson. Like, we never see like Alec Baldwin and Glengarry Glenn Ross at his, like, you know, he comes in this and just berates everybody and unmans them and tells them they can't have coffee. And you're like, wow, what a fucking prep. But we never see him actually good at selling. Right.
Right.
It's so funny because this film has like 5 or 6 different Glengarry Glenn Ross quality speeches interspersed throughout, but like Leonardo DiCaprio shows us, like when he's on the phone working his magic, you can imagine being on the other side of that line getting suckered in. He was very good in like Catch Me If You Can, showing like how a confidence man works. And then he apply this to like Inception, where he very efficiently, I think he has the help from Christopher Nolan, shows what a really good fictitious job like dream infiltrator looks like. Uh-huh. He's just, I don't know, maybe it's his natural charisma and smoothness, which is what you need. But I don't know, because the rest of his crew, who are not smooth and who are not charming or charismatic at all, are able to ape his style and still, because it's over the phone.
Yeah, it's over the phone, and they're using essentially his script. Certainly, like, almost word for word, probably, in the beginning, but then later on, they probably, you know, get the gist of it.
Like, Rugrat as a confidence man doesn't work, because at some point he has to go to your door and, like, personally con you and swindle you. But Rugrat over the phone can absolutely work, because he can sound as smart and sophisticated and suave as a Jordan here.
Yeah.
I don't know, but like I said, we all to say this to talk about the performances. I've never quite seen anything like, and he swings for the fences in a lot of different films, like Revenant, Aviator.
Yeah,
but this stuff he does when he's just in the grips of deep drug and alcohol interactions is hysterical, frightening, and just it feel like I don't know what it feels like to take 4 industrial band quantities of these super lewds and then chase it with a 5th of Jack and then try to get in a Lambo. But I imagine it looks exactly like this.
Oh yeah. No, that is a truly iconic scene. It's one that I will probably never forget having seen. And it's one of, it's the best scene in the movie, but it's also like not head and shoulders above everything else, because everything else in this movie is so damn good. And he has several performances like that throughout the course of this film. That this is one of his more reprehensible characters, I think. Like, you know, the stuff he does in what's the Quentin Tarantino movie where he plays the guy who's
Django Unchained, Candy. Candyland.
That's like the one I can think of off the top of my head that's worse, but like he plays, you know, like this sophisticated, smooth, suave guy, but underneath I can just see the layers of shit that I would, this person is not a decent human being in any way.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Yeah, and one of the other great scenes is where he squares off between him and this FBI agent.
Yeah,
Just after he gets done talking to his PI, who's, you know, like this Mr. Wolf character himself, and he's like, Jesus Christ, do not talk to this. Stay away from this guy. This guy's smart. You're stupid. Yeah. And then you see Jordan being very stupid to this very sharp FBI agent. And right to the point where the FBI agent kind of plays with him, is kind of fucking with him. He's like, I'm getting gold from this guy. I'm getting some charge from him. And then he turns the tables on him and is like, you know, taken down a lot of asshole scumbags on Wall Street, and you know my hat's off to you because they were born to the manor. You know, they came from a long line of scuzzbald, asshole, amoral fathers, but you, Jordan, you did it all on your own. You didn't have the asshole spoon born of the asshole spoon in your mouth. You got there all on your own steam, and it's like one of the most savage backhand compliments I've ever heard delivered.
Yeah.
But that's, yeah, like, how did he get this way? Like, his father kind of seems like a piece of work. but not in a maniacal way that would bring about this. His mom seems like a decent person. He himself had like some kind of moral fiber entering in this, like, oh, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to do drugs, I just want, you know, like,
yeah.
I thought that our, you know, it's like, yeah, sure, we're getting rich, but we're helping other, like, there's no shame in generating wealth for someone and as a byproduct of that, getting wealthy yourself. But
it,
when...
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not just about getting rich for him, right?
It's, I think, about it was, some, but
it's about an addiction to money, yeah, and power. It's
greed.
I think, yeah, in the beginning it is wanting to get rich. And I think, like, what he says about, you know, everybody wants to get rich is mostly true. I think there are people who, you know, value certain things over money, definitely. But everybody wants to get rich in order to, for the security aspect of it, right? And the future of their family, say, yeah, and stuff. Not everybody wants to get rich to be a rich asshole. And that's right. The problem is, I think it went too far, where you become rich and that you let that greed feed back into itself. And then you just don't give a shit who you hurt.
Yeah, you've got, like, because I don't think everyone wants to get rich. I think everyone wants to be left alone and not be fucked with and have a good degree of individual autonomy and freedom. And unfortunately, in our system, the only way to guarantee that is to be filthy, stinking rich.
Yeah,
because that's the only place where you can be kind of unfuckwithable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what people really, really want. I mean, there's ways you can envision a system that, you know, that wouldn't require that, but that's not the world we live in. But it's because, like, I felt like there was that point where Matthew McConaughey takes him out to lunch and he shatters all of his illusions. Like, no, that generating wealth, that's a bullshit. It's all about, you know, how much do you jerk off? Oh, 3-4 times a week. Those are rookie numbers. You need to pump those numbers up. You need to start doing cocaine. You need to start getting yourself shit face drunk. You need to, you know, you need to just keep these guys riding on the merry-go-round because that's how we make money. Fuck them if they don't lose money or if they don't make money. And I think he was a little bothered and sickened by that, but instead he's like, he kind of came away with like, oh, I guess my perspective needs to change rather than this is just amoral and crazy.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the thing. That's the original sin. He decided, you know, when he was, it's not like he worked there for a year while they were paying platitudes and saying that they were doing the right, like, he, you know, this day one, nope, here's the naked unvarnished truth about this industry. And he's like, fuck yeah, I want to go all in. And there was a couple other, like, Jonah Hill coming into his life. Who does that? Why do you give Jonah Hill a job, man? Yeah. And on day one of you doing it, he takes back, say, hey, man, you want to smoke a crack pipe? And then like, yeah, this is the guy I want to start a company with. I thought that was kind of like crazy, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like, I'm glad Jonah Hill's in this film. He's a wild man. He's like this agent of chaos. Do you think it's very unclear to me seeing this movie three times, one with the 7-year gap in between it. What happens at the end? Because Jordan agrees to wear the wire, but he goes to Jonah Hill and he slips him a note saying, don't incriminate yourself, I'm wearing a wire. How does the FBI get that? Is Jonah Hill, are you supposed to understand that Jonah Hill flipped on everyone? But then once he did, why did Jordan get a chance to cooperate again? It's like,
yeah. That's the thing. Once he breaks that deal he's got, I don't know why he isn't just like hit with the fucking book, but like,
yeah,
my impression is that they must have dug this out of their trash or something. I'm not sure how they got it exactly.
It's wild because I you know, if you don't know, I do this other like political podcast thing on the side. It's over at Swizz Bowl. Jim kind of produces it and I do the in front of the mic stuff. But early on, I kind of had like a, you know, kind of anti Wolf of Wall Street take. And I had a surprising amount of pushback on the idea that we should treat white collar crime with the same kind of severity that we do violent crime. You know, like if you murder someone, you get pitted away for 20 years. What should you get if you take 100,000 people's retirement account and flush it down? Like,
yeah,
to me, you are in absolute terms, killing at least one person if you do that, because someone's going to commit suicide if they've, right, you know, if they worked for 40 years and then they got to keep, they got to fucking be greeter at Walmart because their retirement that they counted on is gone. Mm-hmm. Like, but that guy's, oh, you know, you got to make, you got, there's a separation between killing someone and I don't understand. I don't understand. And as long as we have that that sliding scale of justice, we're going to continue to have this. Like, that's the strongest argument for, yes, Jordan Belford or whatever the fuck, Belmont slaying vampires, whatever, werewolf of Wall Street, he should have gone away for 20 years. And if we did that, yeah, for a generation or two, we might have a Wall Street worth fucking, you know, defending and you know, not as rapacious as it is. But as long as we could be like, well, you know, if someone's fuck slinging crack or someone, you know, killed somebody or someone, you know, did this or that, that's a totally different crime than what these people are doing. We're always going to have this slap on the wrist system of justice, which means it, and that just, I feel like it's corrosive to the whole idea of justice. Like, look at what Absolutely. It does as FBI agent at the end. Like, is he going to Yeah, Jordan entering this organization, fresh-faced, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, gets pumped full of this bullshit and destroys the world. And you have this other FBI agent, straight arrow, Boy Scout, fresh-eyed, fresh-faced, bright-eyed. You go through the same system. One guy ends up even just as rich, continue to take advantage of people. The other guy rides home on a subway thinking he's the biggest rube in the world. Is he going to as zealously prosecute the Wall Street guys going forward? Like, I don't know. It's so patently fucked up, but yet people defend it.
And yeah, I mean, that's absolutely, absolutely right. The penalties are not harsh enough. I know that, like, it's not necessarily about the penalty of getting caught, but the certainty of getting caught is what yes. is a effective deterrent. And we have, you know, undermined the IRS and underfunded the IRS and taken out all the safeguards we have against these types of schemes going unnoticed or at least unprosecuted.
Like, defunding the police is so controversial, but we constantly defund the white collar police and no one bats an eye. In fact, it's celebrated.
Yeah. So we need to maybe pump up those systems, but I don't know. It's crazy to me too, because like this movie, I don't want to say like it's wishy-washy on this stuff but it does vacillate between like this is, you know, this guy getting his comeuppance and this guy, you know, this federal agent succeeding and there's a string of scenes where Belford goes to jail where you can see, okay, the federal agent is riding the subway. Just like they talked about on the boat, right? And he's thinking about that. But then that scene is immediately cut to Jordan Belfort riding a prison bus. So like in that moment, you think, oh, well, okay, the subway is far preferable, right, to the prison bus. But then they cut again right back over to his fucking Club Med life he's living in this prison. Yeah,
I forgot I was rich.
Right.
I got to admit, I was scared for a minute going into prison, but then I forgot I was rich.
And it immediately turns that feeling on its head. And that's part of it, right? This whiplash of like, ah, there's justice. Oh, shit, there's not. Oh, but wait, he lost his family. Oh, but he doesn't give a shit and he's still rich.
Right. Right.
There are so many little moments like that where the film is whiplashing you back and forth between those feelings of extreme, you know, envy and joy and excitement and these like depths of despair. And I don't know. I think it's effective because I come out of this film thinking, man, I really enjoyed that ride, but I probably shouldn't have because it's a disgusting ride.
Yeah, and like what the movie stays with, I think, is interesting because there's some things like Jonah Hill fucking with John Bernthal is a delight and also is a pivotal plot point this guy, for why? Why does he do this? It's so needless.
That's it.
And this is the beginning of the end when he pulls this shit and it gets arrested. And I'm like, I understand because they spend like 10 minutes setting up that scene. And then the scene itself is like a good long, you know, just like, man, look at this guy just provoking John Bernthal and he's going to get an epic ass beating. But then they have this thing where there's like a 7-minute scene of them negotiating a contract for little people that they can toss at a dartboard.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what purpose does this serve? It's like kind of black comedy, but
it paints a picture of these people, certainly.
Right. But I don't even know if the movie itself has a certain point of view over it. Does like Martin Scorsese actually kind of think this is cool in a way that you can do something like this and get away with it?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I don't know. Because in the gangster movies, I always get the feeling that like he's writing a love letter to a bygone era, which he acknowledges is a nasty thing. But also there's some romance to it.
Sure.
And I feel like he's doing the same here, but I don't know that I quite feel the same. I don't quite get the same vibe from this as I do from those.
And there's like others, like you could say the same thing, I guess, about the Ferrari, the Lambo scene, though that is again a piece of art.
Yeah.
And also it's a pivotal plot point, you know, like Jonah Hill fucked up and has always been a fuck up. And he's trying to hide the fuck up with an enormous amount of drugs, which has been an increasing pattern in this movie. And now it's built. He's made a mountain into fucking Vesuvius. It's now a volcano exploding. And so it's like, it's not only just like on the face of it funny. And also it works at like in the rules of three. It's super funny to see him just go instantly comatose and pass out on his hotel floor. It's super funny to watch him try to get out the front door and into this car. And then the punchline is when the cops come.
Yep.
And he's like, what are you talking about? It's only a mile I got home with that. And you go and see the Lambo and it just looks like it's been through a fucking wood chipper.
Yeah.
And like but there's like a bunch of scenes like that where they went on for a pretty long time. Like there's this long discussion that he has with his father about Bush.
Uh-huh. I love that scene, but I don't really know what purpose it serves.
Yeah. And I also wonder how much of this dialogue was scripted versus how much of it was improvised, because some of this stuff with like Jonah Hill feels very like him and Bernthal going out felt very improvisational, like you know. And I wonder if he got like some of these very talented actors and it's like Martin Scorsese like, I can't cut any of this Bush talk, it's gold, you know, I can't cut any of this like look how like the rugrat negotiating and talking about oh you can't touch their dick, but oh this guy you can, he's weapons free on dicks, like
seems to be like partially improvised, and also I'm really not sure what purpose that serves other than to establish characters as assholes. The scene with the Bush talk to me is trying to convey some sort of corrupting influence of this life, right? Like or the world as it progresses, because like you get the two generations of guys, right? And Rob Reiner is like, God, they have no Bush now. They're shaved from the eyebrows down. What? Yeah. Wow. If I was a young man, I don't know what I'd do. That sort of thing, right? Like, and you may or may not like Bush, whatever. But like, there is a sort of like lifestyle creep, right? Like cultural creep toward the lavish, you know, the drug fueled binges. You know, the sex parties, like shit happened, you know, back in Rob Reiner's day. I'm sure of it. Right. You don't live through the 60s without your share of sex parties. Right.
Oh, right. Like the posh British aunt. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. But also like that shit creeps. It's like Magic the Gathering. There's power creep. Right. You see, well, the parties, the sex parties, the 60s existed. Yeah. But come on, they were probably tame compared to the ones that are going on Wall Street, right? Flying transatlantic on a fucking airplane and having an orgy in there, right?
That bacchanal, yeah.
Rob Reiner probably never did that. Yeah, so there is a corrupting influence, right? It's not all just like, these guys are terrible people. It's also partially this feedback loop.
There's speaking of Jonah Hill, I one of the questions I had is like, did he eat that goldfish? Because that's either really good CGI or practical effect, or he ate a fucking goldfish. I looked into it, and I guess he wanted to eat goldfish. And Scorsese's like, you can't eat goldfish, Jonah. If you do that, the PETA people will fuck us. We won't get that label on the film, and there'll be a shit show. So like Jonah Hill's like, calm down, man. You want to eat a goldfish? The compromise they worked out is that he could keep the goldfish in his mouth for 3 seconds.
Okay.
So he put a real-life goldfish in his mouth, rolled it around for 3 seconds, and spit it out in the water, apparently unharmed.
Boy,
I don't know
Does that make it better?
Did a veterinarian, did an ichthyologist like sign off on the rolling around in Jonah Hill's filthy mouth for, you know, just been sucking fake blow off a hooker's ass like the shot before they sign off on that? But like, it's lunatic. And there's other things that I wondered what the point of is, like when they're showing the Steve Madden shoes deal. What's the point of having them lampoon this guy? Like, why did Jordan let his entire bullpen tear into this guy and mock him and throw shit at him before he comes in and talks about what a genius he is? And then, like, all that's beside the point because here's a script that's going to sell these fuckers, has nothing to do with it. Right. Like, is that, I kept on wondering, it's like, is this saying something about this type of career, like this type of industry, that he's trying to say that like these guys aren't even particularly good managers? How can they be? Like, these aren't geniuses. These aren't brilliant people. These are coked up lunatics doing everything wrong, being offensive and off-putting. And it doesn't matter because the other people's greed is such that they want in on this IPO. They don't want to miss out. They got this fear of missing out.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't know, like, that's the thing. Like, this movie's perspective seems to be that everything on Wall Street, everything involving fiat currency or the stock market, is a bunch of bullshit. It doesn't matter. I don't personally believe that, despite, you know, some of my political rhetoric. I am still a capitalist and I want to believe that there is something to all this. But like, goddamn, it does seem like anytime I've seen a documentary on the inner workings of some of these things, like in the smartest guys in the room at Enron, this fucking thing with the Belmont Buford Lion Corporation, they all seem, and like my own experiences in like Fortune 500 companies, I don't think there's geniuses on top. I think it's a lot of fucking dumb luck and hard work of people in the middle and the bottom and, you know, customers liking things. And it's like this idea that you've got somebody that's worth $100 billion at the top because, you know, every once in a while they take a break from sniffing blow off a hooker's butt and they make a decision about which big money thing to push into. Like, it does seem like a fallacy.
Yeah. And they don't even necessarily have to take a break from the blow to make that decision, as like, spectacularly demonstrated in this movie, right? That scene on the boat with the pool party with the pool table, and they're playing beer pong and Jonah Hill. This movie loves lewds, man. Every time it's a fucking opera. They go into, you know, Jonah Hill pops a lewd and they kick in.
They make it seem like a slow-mo drug from Dread. You know, everything's going in slow time and it's all candy colored. And yeah,
you know, that reminds me, the thing that I like so much about that Lambo scene when those lewds kick in is it gives you a moment there where it's like, okay, it's the distorted camera and you're feeling what it's like to be in his head. But then seeing it from the outside, right? Mm-hmm. Seeing this character trying to get to his Lamborghini in completely sober shots. You know, it's like you're standing in that driveway watching this lunatic. Mm-hmm. There's something about the disparity there between what's happening in his brain and what we're seeing play out in real life is absolutely hysterical to me.
And it's also kind of relatable because, like, you know, I've known people that get blackout drunk on a regular basis and like, oh, bro, man, I was like, fucking wait, I don't even fucking remember last weekend. Well, then what did you do it for, man?
Yeah.
Like that scene where he's talking about the four stages of lewds and like the uptake phase seemed like recognizable fun. But when he's getting like some prostitutes grinding on him and he's like drooling and eyes crossed and is never going to remember it, like, what's the fucking point?
Yeah.
Like it. And I think there's something that the movie's trying to say about that, too. It's like, well, the point is, I don't know. You do so much bad shit that you just want to turn your brain off. Like, you just can't deal with anything harsh sober. Like, you're going to go sinking on a ship. Like, that's the other funny thing. It's like, how many times these guys went off to save $10, $20 million and lost 100? Like, how much money do you think he lost when that ship sunk? The helicopter,
was it insured? I don't know.
Like, the 120-foot yacht,
nothing.
and he did that just to save $20 million that his dead aunt, you know, he had to do some kind of crazy probate scam involving these corrupt Swiss bankers to save it, and he probably lost $80 million. I don't know, man. It's just that's the thing. Like it's not even real. Like none of the losses that they experience are ever seemingly real. Like, you know, there's always this talk of like, well, maybe I'll lose my house, maybe I'll do this, but the only thing they really lose is their humanity and their human connections to people, and it doesn't seem to matter.
And I think that's the point, you know, of showing the excess in the drugs. It's to link it to the excess in the money, because they're both, you know, the film all over it is saying that money is a drug, that he is an addict. And that's the point, right? In those scenes where you're seeing how far this guy goes and how pointless it all is, you're supposed to be thinking the same thing that you're thinking about the lewds for the money.
Yeah. I had that feeling too. There's a scene where there's like three times it happens where someone comes, and it's usually John Favreau. He goes and says like, "Hey, you got to take this deal, or they're gonna fuck you. You got to take this deal." Finally, he's like, "No, seriously. Like, this was after the Lambo incident. You've got to take this deal, and you can just essentially walk away scot free." Mm-hmm. You know, like, even though they got you dead to rights, if you just voluntarily give up this company and say you promise you'll never work on Wall Street again, everything will go away. You get to keep the house, you get to keep the supermodel wife, you get to keep the Lambos, you get to keep the cruisers, you get to keep it all. And he agrees. His dad's like, "Jordan, this is a great deal. This is a sweetheart deal. Take it." And I got the feeling as he's given this speech about going away, that is like it's like the speech that sells a rube on a penny stock. And he's doing it to himself.
Yeah.
Like, his future is now a penny stock. It's worth nothing. But he's still talked himself into it. And he's going to buy. And he's going to double down. Like, "Oh, you want to buy for three? You know what? How about five? You know what? Make it 10. And that's what he fucking does. But still, it's like the satisfying thing is if he had actually got brought down and brought down hard. Yeah, you know, like Goodfellas, the guy, like, there's some kind of poetic justice of this guy who, you know, took all the shortcuts and got ahead because he wanted to be somebody, being a nobody and a forcible nobody. Because if he ever tries to be somebody again, some mafia asshole will come and whack him.
Yeah.
You know, there is none of that justice on this side of the street.
No.
Because it's just, yeah. So even though he doubled down every single time and had all these moments of clarity, like, it just doesn't matter because nothing ever stuck.
So that raises another issue that a lot of people had with this movie, in the, you know, glorification of these sorts of behaviors, and that lifestyle, but also the movie itself, and the fact that it's made. So let me lay a little groundwork. Jordan Belfort, the real human Jordan Belfort, you know, did all these things, got indicted and got sent to prison for a while, came back out, wrote a book, called The Wolf of Wall Street, his autobiography, which is what this movie is based on. Also, Jordan Belfort started a motivational speaking career after this. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what you see in the end of this film is actually it's Jordan Belfort, the real life Jordan Belfort, introducing Leonardo DiCaprio as Jordan Belfort.
That's cool. Okay, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, in the sell me this pin scene.
I guess it's not cool. Fuck you. You should be in jail. But yeah.
So that's what I want to talk about. Like, I'm kind of gross. The most despicable thing about this film existing to me is that Jordan Belfort then profited off of all this after the fact. He made more than $1 million off of this film. I don't know that I can abide the fact that. So there's a question of like, should Martin Scorsese have read this book and then adapted a screenplay that was fictionalized and had nothing to do with Jordan Belfort per se, right? Just had a lot of this story because it's not an uncommon tale among the Wall Street crowd, I have to imagine. Yeah. And then not given Jordan Belfort a goddamn dime. Or is it okay that he took this and made it, you know, based on this book of this man's life story and ended up giving him more money? An obscene amount of money by most people's standards, $1 million to make this film.
Especially when you realize that that's Jordan at the end, he's literally sucking his own dick.
Dude, and making it feels really gross when you find out a couple of behind the scenes facts about this movie.
And yeah, he's sucking his own dick and getting $1 million+ for it too.
And the company name in the film of his motivational speaking company is his actual motivational speaking company's name. So he's getting so the people, free publicity from millions of people seeing this movie too. It's I don't like it, frankly.
There's a ton of people out there who are the rubes or who are going to look at this movie and these the most. I guess the most profitable rube is the rube that thinks they're the smartest guy in a room. And this is the exact kind of thing, like, you know, some guy coming out of there and like, you know what? That guy beat the system and he made all that money and he got the tongue of gold that can sell. I want in on that. And those are the type of people that they're going to funnel to Jordan and he's going to take them for all. It's almost like if they had the Fyre Festival documentaries and it led up to promoting Fyre Fest 2.
Right.
More Fyre, more Fest.
Dude, same it's guy. Fucked up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I said, I think the way to do it is if we treat financial white-collar crime at sufficient scales. Like, we should have escalators. Just like, you know, you rob a store, that's one thing. You rob a store with a gun, that's one thing. You rob a store as a previous offender. Like, it just gets worse and worse and worse for you. I think we need those kind of accelerators and stuff on the white collar crime. But like, so much of it is just like recouping money that, you know, if you can get a couple $1 million shooken free for the victims fund. Like, what was it? Like, they recovered $3 million for the victims fund. What is that? Is everyone gets 3 cents that he's ever ripped off?
And he pay like 50% of his salary up until 2009 toward, you know, restitution, and the total.
But how much does he still have in
like
his Swiss accounts?
$110 million. But
that's the
other
thing. How much
that?
Does he have in his Swiss accounts? Like, who the fuck knows? Right. He's taking money to Switzerland, $20 million at a time.
How about this? We take the average American salary, and we divide the amount of money you stole by that. The average annual American salary. We take the amount of money you stole, divide it by that number, and that's how many years you do.
It does seem like, because like I'm thinking about how much in common this had in piracy. Like, piracy was endemic when there's a lot of money to be had. There's a lot of nations in, you know, international waters doing, you know, like, you had the Dutch, you had the English, you had Spain, you had the French, and there's like, you know, like territorial disputes, and there's like a lot of murky details. And then once the international community came together and like, you know what? Fuck pirates. Pirates went down to Davy Jones' locker.
Yeah.
And it does feel like there has to be an internet, because like the big part of the problem is you have places like Switzerland, you got places like Monaco, you got places like the Grand Caymans that openly engage in this high stakes white collar piracy. And until the international community gets together and is like, you know what, fuck this stuff. But the problem is the people that have to do that are the ones that are profiting and hiding the money and corrupt.
That's the thing, man. Cause part of me like looks at those Swiss accounts and I'm like, oh damn. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Like, if they're going to take advantage of these loopholes, why shouldn't I be doing the same thing? Right. If that's the system, fucking do it. Cause you're a fool if you don't. But the people who would have to enforce, you know, punishment on that type of behavior are just as incentivized in some cases to do the same things when they get in the position where they understand, you know, what's happening and how to fix it.
Yeah, it's a shame that these accounts are private and we can never find out who they belong to or who's engaging in it, except for this was all leaked out in the Panama Papers and no one gave a shit. So it's a damn shame we can never get to the bottom of it, Jim, except for we always do.
Yeah. And we just don't care.
It's a fun movie. It's a really fun movie. It's so easy to watch. It's like drinking Kool-Aid. You know? But is that Kool-Aid got cyanide in it? Is that Kool-Aid got angry juice? Is going to keep me angry about it? Probably not. I don't know. But it's a hell of a movie. The performances alone, holy shit. Did this get any... I can't remember whether got anything for Oscars.
Let's go over the awards.
I know Martin Scorsese is like perennially fucked over by the Oscars.
Well, this was no different. Although I will say he was up against some stiff fucking competition this year.
That was a Dallas Buyers Club year.
Dominated by Dallas Buyers Club and 12 Years a Slave. So Best Picture, it was nominated for that. It lost to 12 Years a Slave. It was nominated for Best Director, Scorsese. It lost to Alfonso Cuarón, Gravity. Best Actor, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, that hasn't aged well.
Gravity?
I mean, yeah, Gravity.
Direction?
I guess you're right.
It's pretty outstanding.
Yeah, it feels a little like Forrest Gump versus Goodfellas, or
sure.
Was it Forrest Gump versus Pulp Fiction? I can't remember which Oscar travesty happened.
Yeah. Best Actor, Leonardo DiCaprio got beaten by Matthew McConaughey in Dallas Buyers Club. Jonah Hill as Best Supporting Actor got beat by Jared Leto from Dallas Buyers Club.
That's horseshit.
Best Adapted Screenplay for Terrence Winter got beaten by John Ridley for 12 Years a Slave. So didn't actually win anything it was nominated for, though it was nominated for 5 awards.
Damn. And yeah. Like, it makes sense. Like, we were talking about pre-podcast that Matthew McConaughey has this very gaunt, cadaverous look that suited the character so well that he got, because he was shooting this in conjunction with Dallas Buyers Club, where right. he played a gaunt, cadaverous guy dying of AIDS.
And it's an outstanding film and an outstanding performance from McConaughey. I don't know which one I would pick, frankly. Like, they're both so different, but so fucking good. And this is one of the best roles I've ever seen Leo in, so I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yes, yeah, Leo is...
How do you pick?
He's got a lot. He's been in a lot of good stuff, and he's, like, sneaky, one of our generation's greatest actors. Is that
still
fair?
Pretty,
like, I feel
young.
Like, yeah. Yeah. He's got a long career ahead of him. Gotten up to some Jordan-esque hijinks of his own. Like, he was famous a couple of years ago for, what, having 30 supermodels he was fucking on a big boat at some point?
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely likes the ladies. I don't know if he likes the blow or the lewds, but probably
that's
likes
the other
booze.
Thing is, like, when I see a movie like this, I wonder, like, is this like some kind of like Roman Caligula thing? Like, once you get past the gauzy veil of like the public rhetoric versus like what's actually going on, is this like literally every stock broker institution? Is this literally every high profile political outfit? Is this literally every big money CEO party? Because I've heard a lot, like, I never got to those kind of, but like the low levels of corporate America I clung to, like, you definitely started hearing the rumors of like the golf outings where they were all the flag girls were prostitutes and strippers, and if you tip them $100 they might let you dip their putter in their pussies for extra luck, and like, and they were telling this and I was just sitting back thinking, that's fucked up, man, all for all kinds of reasons. Like, why is that fun? I don't know.
Is the putter a euphemism? Is it a nickname or literally the putter?
I mean, who knows? If you might have some, but like, I think it's literally like a putter. This is as it was foretold to me at some big Midwestern golf outing. This isn't like on Wall Street or in L.A. or anything. This is just what's going on in Middle America amongst the big wigs. So, Wolf of Wall Street, 2013, hell of a movie. It's an easy way to pass 3 hours
for sure.
Well, that'll do it for The Wolf of Wall Street for this week. Next week on the Prestige feed, thank God, Jim, we've got some prestigious television coming back.
Finally.
It's been a long time since we covered anything prestigious on television, because it's been a long time since prestigious stuff has been on the air. But Fargo, season 4, after being gone for, I think, 27 years, it went off the air the same time MASH wrapped up, I believe. I believe Alan Alda signed off the airwaves the same time Ewan McGregor's evil twin did. But they're finally back. COVID tried to delay it and stop it, but they could not be denied. Fargo season 4 starts this next week, and we have a double episode out next Tuesday for that. We do have some more prestigious movies coming up, but they will be in the weeks ahead. Please come back for Fargo. Fargo is an amazing series of television. Also, if you're on the fence about it, even though it's season 4, you don't need any deep lore understanding. These are an anthology, so you can just jump in any time, and it's going to be a hell of a time to jump in. You got Chris Rock, you got Timothy Oliphant, you got Jason Schwartzman, you got just loads of star power double barreled pointed at you. 2 episodes. We'll be back for Fargo season 4 is what I'm getting at. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you then.